Good evening. Well, I'm sure you enjoyed the film, now we have Joanna to tell us a bit about it.
Hello. Hi, nice to see everybody. Very nice to see everybody, because I haven't... Well, I've just actually, when the film first screened, it did have a sort of very socially distant event at the NFT, but other than that, there's been no screenings with any audience or any opportunity to talk to audiences or hear opinions or anything, which is really sad. So it's especially nice to be here with people who've just watched it and hear your thoughts.
Okay, well, I think perhaps I'm aware of the fact that we have to be out of here by 10 o'clock. So I will... perhaps ask Joe a couple of questions and then throw it open to the floor. What I'd like you to do, if you do have a question, shout it out and then I will repeat it so that we can get it onto the recording that we're making of this evening, so that other people who aren't here can enjoy what we've heard. So let's go. I was interested to find out how you found out about the film. Did the director approach you directly, or was it through an agent? Or
yeah, it was my agent. It was a very straightforward auditioning process.
Right.
You know, got a script alongside everybody else who's in my casting bracket, who also got the script on that list. That's us. And. And then we all went in for it, and I ended up getting it. But I think it was quite a rigorous process,
right,
of auditioning. It was more like a workshop, I would say, than an audition. It went a lot further than generally.
Right.
And I think that's because Aleem had a very, very clear idea of what he wanted and who he wanted. What qualities he was after, and I think that was why he sort of did it differently. But it's also because he's a first-time director and he wasn't really used to the usual ways of doing things.
Sure,
I think
yeah.
He was just going with what he felt was natural to him, and,
right.
And that wasn't necessarily what, you know, the sort of professional sort of ordinary ways of doing things. And that probably was quite interesting for him, because he got to know people a lot better than you would otherwise.
Yeah. And I read an interview with him, and I got the impression that his mother was quite a help in actually getting you into the character.
Yes, she was amazing. So Mary Fahima is based as a character, not really in terms of her personality traits, nor actually in terms of the story, but there's something about him, Aleem's mother's story. She's called Wendy and Fozzie. Those are her two names. And the film is in many, many ways, as a piece of writing, a sort of homage to her.
You're right.
And she has an exceptional story as far as I'm concerned. She's the same age as me, a little bit older, and in the 70s lived in Walthamstow as a white working class girl, living in a big one of those tall council blocks that have got the pillars underneath.
Oh,
which
yeah.
are some of which I know have been taken down now. She lived there, and she met a young Pakistani immigrant who had come to live with his aunt and uncle, I think, when he was 17, and they met under those pillars, you know, where all the teenagers hang out, kind of thing, and fell in love. And her dad was an unusual, well, in a way, an unusual person at that time, in that he was a communist, so I think he was very much pro-internationalism and the reach for all sorts of kinds of, you know, multiplicities. So I don't think she encountered any family prejudice against this union, but nevertheless there were quite a few obstacles, and it took some time, but eventually they were married, and they had been married and had six children. And I think the kind of life that she's lived in a very quiet way has been quite revolutionary, really. She took on Islam and has deep faith. I thought that was, for me, one of the most interesting and inspiring elements of her story. And when I talked to her, she taught me how to cook the saag paneer, how to make roti, though we didn't do it in the film, but I now have a recipe. And I've always been, you know, I'm always interested in cooking, and she's a really good cook, and I love Indian food, so we had a lot of time doing that, so the sort of practical side of sharing some time together, but also just hearing her talking about her life. And I think she's been very brave and very courageous, and I think Aleem is her second child, first boy, and I think she has a very close relationship with him, and the film is some way a kind of honouring of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it gets infused with something quite authentic and real, and he's very cleverly turned that into a story that's absolutely nothing to do with his mother or his family, but has elements. I mean, he would talk about questions of identity and what it's been like for him as a child of that marriage, and what it's like for him as a gay man, and what that has all meant. But I think for myself, because I was really dealing with taking on Mary, that for me it was about the feminine and who she is as a woman and what she is as a spiritual presence, and who and where she sees herself as a good person and where she lets herself down, if you like, on one level, and betrays some of her ideals.
Mm, yeah. What I found about your performance was that although there's a certain amount of dialogue, most of it was being done through sort of virtually wordless emotions. Was it your feeling that the script pushed you in that sort of direction?
Yeah, I mean, it is a cinematic script. It doesn't do the work of the storytelling isn't always done with dialogue. In fact, it's very rarely done with dialogue in this.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of its strengths as a script. It tells a story through pictures, through images, through moments of emotional change, I guess. I mean, I hate to use the word journey, but there's something of that. A sort of one stage to another stage to another stage of emotional intensity. So I guess it was a properly mature script. I think that's one of the things that's difficult for first-time writers in cinema, especially because a lot of people have been trained in television, which is a much more dialogue-heavy and doesn't tell stories with images hardly at all in television. And I think it was a very mature script, and I think Aleem had been shepherded very well through the process of training. He'd had a lot of support from BFI, BBC Films, from Mathieu de Braconnier, who's the producer of this, through the Bureau and various schemes like Rain Dance. And, you know, you can see that it took 6 years. He's on record for saying it took 6 years to write it. And that's because of those number of stages of input to turn it into something that's properly cinematic. And in terms of performing that, then obviously that's just about trying to go to those emotional places.
The scene in the water, I mean, obviously that must have been quite difficult to do, but how difficult was it to sort of block out the fact that you're in freezing cold water it's very uncomfortable, and just think about what the character might be feeling at that point.
I love cold water. I've swum through two winters without a wetsuit at Brockwell Lido, so
right.
I absolutely love cold water, and I was dying to do those days in the sea, and I would have stayed there happily for days afterwards as well. It was great. I mean, it's Calais, it was July. I mean, it really genuinely isn't cold water, as
right.
It was like I don't know, 16 degrees, 17 degrees or something. And so, yeah, it's on the chilly side, but it's bracing and delicious and wonderful. And there's, you know, lovely beaches. And I think what's interesting about that sequence, on a practical level, it was tricky to shoot because we didn't have the kind of physical apparatus, we didn't have the budget for physical apparatus to make it a really, you know, very well organized sort of set of shots.
Right.
So the camera operator and DP, Alexander Dynan, who's an absolute genius, I'm sure you will all have appreciated his framing and the way he put this film together visually. I mean, he's really wonderful. And he did, I want to call it First Reverend. It's not called First Reverend, is it? That film with Ethan Hawke. First Reformed.
Yes,
First
that's
Reformed.
Right. Yeah,
thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Last year. And that, so, and I think he's built on that. And he's, he, I mean, I just think he's very special and he will have a great career, continue to have a great career. So Alex was trying to hold the camera, but the waves were really coming quite fast and quite intensely behind, and there was no sort of rig to put that, to hold that together. So it was really a bit dangerous, and at one point he did very, very nearly drop the camera on my head because another of these waves came from behind, which he couldn't see, of course, and luckily the grip was there and literally gripped. So we... And as it was happening, I was thinking, this is a bit dangerous, but there are times with cinema, and low-budget cinema, where you can't... You just have to take the risk. And if something terrible happens... and it does. We've heard this terrible story recently. Mm. I mean, it does. It does happen. I'm not saying it should happen, but... The circumstances around making film, particularly low-budget film, as much as you can put in safety, health and safety measures, you can't guarantee that you will come out of it totally unscathed as an actor. I feel like that's a heinous thing to say on record, but that's how it feels at the time. You feel like, I have to take a risk. I can't guarantee my own safety in this moment. I'm handing it over to other people, to this whole team. And I don't mean to exaggerate this moment, but there was an element of that in it, just being in the sea and the kind of, you know, the waves and the, if something happened, something would have happened. So that's one interesting thing about that sequence. And the other interesting thing is it was actually tied to a whole plot that went in the edit, which I won't go into any detail of because you won't, it's of no interest now. It remains on the cutting room floor. But that sequence was connected to that other plot. So it's a beautiful edit job because it tells a very different story from the one I was playing.
Right.
At the time. In essence, it's the same, but there was many other factors that I was playing that have been edited neatly to tell a different story. And that's it's really true that a film is, you know, that a performance rather is made in the edit, and that I always see my job as being just to throw out as many options for that edit as possible, and allow that you can't control it. So you might as well just offer as much as you can and then see what happens for your editor. And we had the most amazing editor on this film. Really, really... I know he worked with Alim really in great detail, and
right.
They made some very bold choices as they went. Yeah.
Yeah. One last question. The scene at the beginning in what's obviously after the funeral, and you're there in that white costume, which is complete contrast to everybody else in the room. Is that a traditional widow's costume?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the Islamic widow wear.
Right.
I don't know what the term... There is a name for it. I'm sorry, I don't know that term, or I can't remember it right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anybody else here who would know the word for it. But that white is... what a widow wears
right.
at the funeral and at the event after the funeral.
So I suppose it's like a lot of culture. I mean, like in Japan, I think white is the sort of mourning costume, isn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but it works anyway because it puts you there completely, isolated from everybody else that was around you.
Yeah. Sure. And looks very different, doesn't it, from everyone else?
Yes.
Yeah, and there is. We went through the process of this ceremony as it would be done. So the first stage of it is with the women. So the widow is with the women.
Yeah.
And then later on the men come in, particularly, for example, the brother of the deceased.
Yes.
Then, you know, it's sort of all the stages of family are brought in a very formal way to pay their respects to the widow at that point.
Yeah.
Which, again, we filmed all of that and I'm not sure really that a lot of it remains as such, but it was very important for me to spend that time with the other actors who were playing my sister-in-law and my my brother-in-law and all of that. I mean, I spent a lot of time with them and talked to them and felt very rooted in that family.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of it has ended up not being present. And equally, I should say that, again, partly due to the edit, so there was a lot of work done with Ahmed, Mary and Ahmed as characters, that few scenes that went in the edit. So we now end up with this scene which you know you've just seen at the beginning where he dies very quickly, but there had been about four or five other scenes prior to that which we played and we did, and I worked a lot with Nasser, the actor playing Ahmed, and got to know him, got to be extremely fond of him, and I think that we shot that in sequence, as in it was before we went to Calais, so that remained in my mind all the time. This presence of Ahmed, in my head was my relationship with Nasser, who I'd had such a lovely time with, and I think that really contributed a lot to Mary's attitude towards her husband, who in some cases you would say didn't deserve her affections any longer, or had betrayed her, but underneath it I had always had this compelling sense of affection for him.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I think is in the film. It remains in the film.
Yeah.
But again, in my way of working, I have to use everything that really happens in real life to make to do the acting. So if I really like Nasser, then that's going to come over.
Yes.
And if I didn't like him, that would have come over too. And then you'd have a slightly different film. Because I just can't not use reality. I don't know why. I just can't live in the world of pure artifice. It doesn't work for me, so.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, has anybody else got any questions they'd like to ask? Yes. The question is about whether Joe had to learn Urdu and how she worked with that.
Well, there's the Urdu and there's the Arabic. So there's a namaz prayer in Arabic, and I think there's another couple of moments of Arabic. Both felt like a bit of a challenge at the beginning. Urdu, I didn't need to go beyond the dialogue. Although we did need to make that scene seem as the scene of chatting, the kitchen, you know, the dining table, the scene of chatting with Talid Solomon. We needed to have that a sense of informality about it. So it needed to be pretty familiar. And of course, the scene is about whether he speaks Urdu or not. So that I needed to be convincingly able to speak it. But in fact, that was just a matter of practice. That was just rehearsal. I didn't then go and learn any further words or anything. But the pronunciation was hard for me to get. But then it would have been for Mary as well. So I could kind of use that. I wasn't trying to pass as somebody who had grown up with Urdu. It had always been a second language. And with the Namaz prayer, that I found extremely hard to learn. I tried and tried, and I was learning it for sort of weeks, really, and it just wasn't sitting well. And I'd go to rehearsal with Aleem, and he'd say, you know, it needs to be quite casual. As I don't know how many people here have grown up in religious families, but I did. I grew up in a Roman Catholic family where you just, you know, all those kind of prayers and whatever, they were slightly thrown away. There's a sense of it's not your main focus as you're doing it. It's sort of to the right, and you're kind of doing something else as well. And that, and Aleem would show me the Namaz prayer, and he would have that quality. And I'd think, oh, how can I get this? Because I got this stretch of the sounds of Arabic, which are quite alien, at the same time as having to get the prayer itself as if I've said it 100,000 times. So it was really tricky. And then eventually it clicked, as in I got the words, I could remember them in sequence, but I still wasn't happy with it. And one day, it was when we were shooting the stuff on the cliffs, White Cliffs of Dover, our wonderful White Cliffs of Dover, which I think is such a clever image in this film. And there we were. It was actually before the official shoot had started, because that drone, well, you didn't see the drone, you saw the shot, but you know, you see that shot from a long, long way away, looking at the cliff and leaving the three at the end, the last image of the film. So that drone has to be quite a chunky drone, because it had to go so far out. It couldn't just be like, there's a lot of shooting drones which are a bit more, you know, manageable. You don't have to be. So that means it was less available. So we had to shoot it before the film even started shooting, that very last image. So we were sitting around in the tea house, you might all know it, on the White Cliffs of Dover, just by the little lighthouse, where there's a nice little tea house, highly recommended. And Talid's mum was there, and she is Syrian. They live in Paris. And I said to her, oh, this Namaz prayer, I'm having so many problems with it. I just, you know, do you know it? She's a Muslim. She said, yeah, I'll record it for you. Put your phone on and I'll say it for you. And she said it, and said it so, I don't know what the word is. I was going to use the word beautiful, but that's not correct. It was this sense of pure spiritual connection. So it was very casual, very relaxed, because she says it all the time, but it also had a quality of spirituality in it, which I just went, that's it, I got to get that. That once I've got that sense of that's the through line for it, then I can play it. And then all the words began to kind of come into sequence, and it made sense. So in terms of, it's where all those things come together, language, meaning, intention, it all has to happen at the same moment. And how you adopt a new language in terms of playing the scene depends on what you're hoping to get out of that scene, or what the reality of playing it is with the other person as well.
Yeah, I like the bits, but I mean, you know, because it was quite ambiguous where you suddenly stop, and you know, I was sort of thinking, has she forgotten the words? Is she caught up in the emotion of it? And then you sort of started again. And you know,
that's when I forgot my lines, don't worry.
It was.
About it.
Oh, okay. No, fair enough.
But I did lots of takes without that. But right. Without kind of that like moment of stumbling. But that's what they wanted to use, because I think they wanted exactly what your response was, which is is this feeling, is this something else? Is this, you know,
yes.
Just to unsettle you. Bring you back into a sense of expectation and hope.
Yes. Certainly
would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, another question?
When your husband died, you seemed to not turn to your Muslim family. You became quite an independent character, obviously assertion, and you remained, and you didn't see much of them.
Yes, the question is that when the husband died, Mary's character seems to avoid the Muslim family.
Sorry,
We didn't. Well, she was avoiding them. They continually phoned up, and she didn't answer the phone. Yeah.
Yeah, and they come. Did they come to the door still?
Yes, they did come to the door. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she's thrown back on something in herself by the grief. That the way I interpreted that bit of story is that I thought she's thrown back into herself because she's absolutely bereaved and lost without this person and cannot normalize it for a moment. And then once she gets this piece of information about her husband's other world or something, mystery, whatever it is that she begins to follow when she gets on the bus, takes her away from them. There was stuff that again went in the edit, but was things like she rang up at one point, asked them to feed the chickens. Did you see the chickens?
Yes, we did see.
So she rang them at one point when we were in Calais. There was a scene in the cafe. She's sitting saying, ringing them up and saying, you know, I'm sorry I haven't been in touch, but can you please feed the chickens? In case anyone was worried about what had happened to the chickens. And there were things like that. So there were little bits of connection, but I think emotionally it's correct that she had separated herself. And I think one of the big effects of grief, which affects people in different directions, but can be isolation. Just like I don't trust myself to be around anybody else in case I encounter something I can't cope with or don't want to cope with. So I think it was a sort of grief response initially, rather than any sort of rejection because they had done anything wrong. That's how I interpreted it. I don't think she... I wasn't thinking of her as shame, feeling shame. The other thing about this, again, it's the edit, is that the scene you see when she is at the when the baby's having the head shave, yes. That ceremony,
yeah,
was actually set before the death of Ahmed originally.
Oh, because yes, they do comment about it when they come in. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So there are bits of, there are nuggets of kind of intention of mind that remain sort of orphans really in that process. So, I mean, and this is normal, isn't it? This happens on every film. But in terms of shame, I don't think she's. I didn't put shame in her sort of toolbox particularly. I think she's quite bold actually, and quite kind of rebellious underneath a sense of conformity. Well, you see that, don't you? Because she goes off and does something quite bad, really naughty.
The question is that it was very the emotion that you felt for your husband's character came out. Was that basically your own doing, or was the director directing you down that path, as it were?
Last time I came to David Lean to do a Q&A was for Pincushion.
Yes, indeed.
And Pincushion, Deborah Haywood, is really emotionally very, very finely tuned human being director. And so she and I would say, really did work on where the emotional temperature was at any point. And I mean, it was almost like she was inside me. It was very, very close. Alim is very, by contrast, very distant from that, but very clear about what the image is and what the positioning, you know, the sort of the way, how the look of the shape of the scene or the image or the frame is going to be and what the action is. So that did leave me in my own space. And I just used whatever I felt at that moment. I mean, you know, obviously I'd done a lot of research and, you know, preparation. But I just had to trust how I was feeling in that moment and played that. And that did often relate, as I said, I use a lot of real experience. So I did feel very alien to Natalie playing Genevieve. I did. I mean, Natalie is like a creature from, you know, she seemed to me like this gorgeous, blonde, sophisticated woman from Paris, actress who's done all these films. She's, you know, she was in Cachet. She, you know, I mean, she was that thing that Mary sees her as. So I had to use all of those, and I was just like this, you know, dumpy character actor, you know, from Britain, England. And I had to play, I had to really go into lots of my own feeling, my real feelings, and try and use those to play the story. That meant that actually I was very unhappy and lonely and isolated all the time. That's how it felt. But that's all to the good, ultimately. It just isn't necessarily a great, you know, great way to spend your days. That's why the sea was so great.
Yeah.
Cheer you up.
Yes. Yeah, the question is that when she goes to the door initially, had Joanna actually thought about what she was going to say, even though in the end she was just mistaken for a cleaner?
Yes, I mean, we have that moment when she looks in the mirror that day in the morning after her shower or whatever, and you see her look and say, my name is Mary. And I think I did have what I thought I was going to say to the person who opened the door. She doesn't know who's lives there or anything. It could be anybody. She doesn't know at that point that it's a woman. She doesn't really know what the situation is going to be. So even though she'd been spying for a little bit before, but it's very unknown. So I think at that moment I was going to say something along the lines of, my name is Mary. I have got some bad news for you, and, you know, say, please may I come in to talk to you, a bit like a policeman at the door. That's what I'd imagined. I didn't imagine she was going in a vengeful, like, you stole my husband. And of course, Solomon is a complete surprise after that too. So there's a whole set of things that follow on. But I think she thinks, I'm going to go and do the right thing, like a policeman knocking on the door and bringing this piece of bad news. That's what I had imagined, but we will never really know.
No.
And of course it's such a great thing that she gets mistaken as for a cleaner, because it pretty much tells you everything you then need to know about both characters.
Yeah.
The gauntlet is been thrown in that moment, and I'm sure it's that. I mean, I did feel it. I felt the humiliation, the deep humiliation of being mistaken for a cleaner, simply because. I had that combination that you get with stinging kind of rage, but powerlessness, at the same moment. And, oh, I mean, even now, if I think about it too much, it just makes me livid. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very clever piece of storytelling, that.
Adrian, yes.
I can't help being intrigued about the unseen edit that was never finished. And I wonder if you could give a sense of how much longer the film could have been in that version. And was that actually assembled in the cut? And would you welcome some of this to be seen as DVD extras or possibly
No, I don't. No, none of those. I mean, I don't think it would have been hugely longer. It's not. I do think it's the perfect length now. I think a good 90 minutes is great amount of time to tell a suspenseful story like this. So I do think it's the right length, and I don't think it would ever have wanted to be longer, even in the original script. And I also think that what went is absolutely right. You know, that wasn't. This is the film, and when you're a writer, you do add sometimes. It takes you ages to get to the point, to get to or rather a bit in that Japanese way of trying to take things away so that you're just left with the white bowl, you know, that which is all you need. It's that process. And so I don't think there is a kind of redux sort of, you know, director's cut, because this is the director's cut. And the editor, yeah, the editor is experienced and skillful and knew how to get to where we needed to be. So forget I ever said any of that. I'm just telling you about process.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, a lot of the great writers, you know, spend their time whittling down what they started off with to get the book that they finally
Killing Your Darlings.
Yes, that's
yeah.
It. Yeah.
It's known as, yes.
Yeah.
No, it was too short a shoot. You know, there wasn't time to kind of like sit around mid-process and think, well, we could do with another one of those, which you do get sometimes on things where you've got much more time and money. Once that clock started ticking, we really had to motor to get that film shot. It was pretty short and it was very intense. And, you know, we had two countries. We had to deal with two, you know, some crew on the other side, some crew this side. You know, it was really quite tricky.
How long was the shoot in the end?
I think 4 weeks or something like. Four, maybe five.
Right. Yeah, that is short.
Yeah. It was good, considering we had travel time and, you know, things like that to get in there as well. Yeah, it was pretty intense.
Right.
And we shot all the Dover stuff first, then we went to Calais, then we came back and did the interior Calais, which was actually shot near Columbia Road Market, which was nice to go for a coffee. That's brilliant CGI.
Yes,
yeah, we would have been very lucky to have caught that, wouldn't we? No, I mean, I think this is one of the lovelinesses in the film, actually. The CGI, which is very low key, but crucial, like the light, the lighthouse light, the lamp from the lighthouse, all of that. That's all CGI. The cliffs, the white coming down from the ceiling, things that seem very real looking, but quite low key, but give it this element of magic realism. This sort of, it's not kitchen sink. It's something. It feels familiar and British in many, many ways, but it's also got this slightly other magical element to it. And I think that's all down to the excellence of that CGI, because they haven't overplayed any of it. Yeah, really good. Although, of course, I didn't have it happening in front of me, so I was really on the ferry, but nothing was happening on the cliff.
Okay, well, I think we should. It's probably time to wind up now. But can I just say, on behalf of all of us, thank you very much for coming along and to this Q&A, and congratulations on what is an absolutely fantastic film.
Thank you. Well, it's always really nice to be amongst friends and neighbours, and please. Anything I can do within David Lean or anywhere else, I'm thoroughly supportive of having independent cinema in Croydon. It seems to me absolutely crucial, and without it we would be at a loss. So I'm glad to be part of it, but also just amongst you as a consumer as well. Thank you
very much. Thank you.